slightly plump little girl who was always quipping. Her mother, Maricela, was on a rare break from her endless whirl of work. She was a nurse in the local hospital, and when she clocked off from that job, she sold necklaces and chains and rings. It was exhausting, but she believed in working hard for her family more than anything. She was saving up to buy a shop. Maricela counted her kids back into the car and, in a moment the family would later remember as like a scene in Home Alone, she must have counted somebody else's kid by mistake. They all clambered in and drove off. All except Ruby. It was only 2 hours later that they realized she was not with them.
"Where is she?"
Maricela gasped. How could this happen? How could she forget her? They drove back in a panic to the last place they had seen her. They expected Ruby to be in tears, or gone. They pulled into the diner.
"Is she... where is she?"
And there was Ruby. She was laughing. She had made friends with another little girl, and she was eating fish. Ruby's older brother, Juan, asked her if she had been scared. "No," she says. "I knew that my mom was coming back for me." Ruby knew that Maricela would always come back for her, no matter what happened. She was right. What she didn't know was quite how far Maricela would have to go to do that. A few years later, Ruby had a crush. A tall, skinny 22-year-old with sticky-outy ears and an impressive line in hard man talk turned up at her mother's new carpentry store in Ciudad Juarez, asking for a job.
"Please help me out. I don't have money to buy food for my little girl," Sergio said. "I'll do anything that needs to be done. Give me a job, at least for a couple of days."
Maricela was feeling soft-hearted, so she made Sergio a carpentry assistant. Soon, her daughter was hanging around him all the time. She was 14, and impressed by his tall tales of being a DJ for a radio station, of being fired because he slept with the owner's daughter, and of owning an AK-47. By now, Ruby had developed fast. She was curvy and precociously beautiful. We don't know when they first become involved. He got a tattoo with Ruby's name on it, and started telling her that her mother didn't love her. "Why is she on your back for not doing well at school, if she really cares about you?" One morning, Ruby was gone. The police refused to go get her. A few months later, Maricela found her, pregnant, and they became friends again, but Ruby ran back to Sergio each night. Just beyond the frame of this small domestic drama, their city was starting to look like the set of the Saw movies. Chopped-up bodies were being found all over the streets of Juarez. Decapitated corpses hung from the traffic overpasses, with signs from the cartels declaring they were in charge now. But this had nothing to do with Maricela and her family. Like most people in Juarez, they looked away and tried to get on with their lives. What else could they do? One day, Ruby's big brother, Juan, turned up to redecorate the flat where Ruby lived, and he was puzzled by what he found. The furniture was gone. The place was empty. There was only one thing, a note from Ruby. It said that she was having a lot of problems with Sergio because Maricela kept criticizing him, and they were going away to find a new life, free of her, far away. Ruby had run off before. She always came back. Christmas came. Ruby didn't call. New Year's Eve came, and still Ruby didn't call. Maricela was puzzled. There had been no fight before she vanished, not this time. Where was she? She decided to visit Sergio's mother to see if she knew. When she arrived, she saw something that startled her. It was Ruby's baby. He was with Sergio, but there was no Ruby. Sergio said Ruby had abandoned them both. To Maricela, this was inconceivable. She could leave Sergio, yes, but her own baby? She looked again at Ruby's letter, and she had a fear. What if she hadn't written it? What if it was faked? When she returned shortly after to visit her grandson, she found Sergio had vanished and taken the baby with him. Maricela and her eldest son Juan decided to print up flyers of Sergio's face and leaflet his neighborhood, Fronteriza Baja, asking people to come forward if they'd seen either of them. But nothing came of it. Then, after 2 weeks, there was a call. It was a teenager named Angel. "I need to talk to you. I'm going to tell you something real hard," he said. "I don't want to talk because I'm scared, but I have a family member who is missing also. I know how you are feeling. I know the feeling you have when you are looking for somebody and you can't find them." When Maricela met Angel, he was shaking. She had to drive him far out of the neighborhood before he was able to form the words he had to say. Months before, he had been hanging out in his hood when Sergio drove up to a group of them and said he needed help. He had to remove some furniture from his house, and there was some quick money in it if they'd help him. So a posse of them, Sergio's brother Andy, Angel, and a 10-year-old boy, went back there. And when they did, they saw Ruby. Her head had been smashed in. She was dead. The kids didn't want to get involved in this. Sergio became furious. "If you don't help me fix this," he announced, "I'll kill you all." So they rolled up Ruby's body and put it in the truck. Sergio drove off with the 10-year-old boy. And Angel had had to live with what he'd seen ever since. Maricela and Juan didn't know what to make of this. The kid seemed plausible, but they didn't want to believe it. She begged Angel to come to the police with her. Finally, terrified, he agreed. The police wrote it up, but still nothing happened. She turned up at the police station every day now, demanding to know. "So what are we going to do today?" "To find Sergio." "What's the next step?" She virtually moved into the police station as a one-woman pressure group, but even now the police were shrugging. "Sergio has vanished. What can we do?" At this point, Maricela made a decision. If the police wouldn't do their job, she would do it. She would become a detective. In the middle of the killing fields of Ciudad Juarez, she was going to become a freelance police force of one. She trawled the mountains around the city, looking hour after hour for Ruby's corpse. Then she headed back to Sergio's neighborhood to hand out flyers. Finally, one day, a woman told Maricela she knew where Sergio was. I can't disclose the details of who this woman was because it might get her killed. But she told Maricela that Sergio was in Fresnillo, 16 hours from Juarez, and gave Maricela his landline number. She took it to the police and... still nothing. They refused to act. Maricela had been feeling ill for a long time. She assumed it was because of Ruby's disappearance, but her doctors told her she was wrong. She had breast cancer, and she needed a double mastectomy, urgently. At this point, most of us would have given up. Maricela did not. A few days after the operation, she set off for Fresnillo. She had tubes attached to each breast to drain the fluid and serum that seeped from her into a container. And then, in Fresnillo, she found him. The local police finally seized Sergio, and he immediately confessed. Yes, he had smashed Ruby's skull. He had set her on fire and tossed her body in the area on the outskirts of the city where the local abattoir dumps the bones and grease from the slaughtered pigs. The police started a search back in Juarez. They were only able to recover one-third of her body. Her arm, a few parts of her head, not even the skull. Just fragments. There were 36 bones in total. The investigators told Maricela that normally, when you are burned, your head explodes through your eyes and your ears. But because Ruby's skull was broken, hers had exploded through the hole in her head. Maricela believed there must be more of Ruby left than that. She drove with her eldest son Juan to the abattoir dump. There were thousands and thousands of pig bones, and wheelbarrows dumping more all the time. They started to scramble through the bones and the grease, a pump still attached to each of Maricela's breasts. There were maggots, and the smell of death, and all these bones. We were going through the bones trying to find one piece of her, trying to find one piece of her. Ruby's brother Juan remembers. Of course, we didn't find anything. Angel testified at the trial. He described everything he saw, and he explained that Sergio had threatened to kill him if he ever spoke out about it. One day, Sergio turned to Maricela from the dock and said, I know that I did a big harm that nobody will be able to repair. She already said that she will not forgive me. But I ask your forgiveness, Maricela, because I know that it was a great harm. And it is true what you said. Where was God at that moment? Unfortunately, I didn't know God at that moment, but I had the good chance to find God in jail. I don't have words. That's all. It was obvious he would be convicted. But then everything took a mysterious turn. The judges said they couldn't accept Sergio's confession because the prosecutor has to be present for a confession to be valid. On these grounds alone, they said there was insufficient evidence and he was acquitted. Maricela always believed in doing things the right way. Now, Juan says, it was like she was betrayed by her own people because she believed in the authorities. She announced, these judges have killed my daughter again. Nobody understood why this had happened, but they knew it wasn't unusual. The murder conviction rate in Juarez is just 2%. Angel, the kid who had testified at the trial, was found dead, along with his family, just as Sergio had promised. Maricela started to walk the streets of Juarez with signs demanding justice for Ruby, holding aloft her picture. She called on all the mothers who had missing daughters to leave their homes and join her. All over the country, people who protested were being murdered, but Maricela would not be stopped. And steadily, as they saw her standing up, other mothers began to come out into the streets to join her, holding aloft their own pictures of their own daughters. They walked all day through the deadliest city in the world, refusing to accept that this is how things would always be. She said in a speech, "It is only a few of us that are gathered here, but there are plenty more waiting at home, crying. We ask you, how many more will it be? How many victims? We stand alone in this struggle. Please join and support us." Everywhere they went, people would shout, "Keep on going!" and, "We're with you!" She was approached by rival cartel members who said they could deal with Sergio if she wanted. Some of her family were tempted, but Maricela refused. She believed in justice, not violence. "It may be the last thing I do," she said, "but I will capture my daughter's murderer." She went to interview everybody who had ever known Sergio, to beg them for information. And finally, somebody gave her an address in Fresno, a city 900 miles away. Almost as soon as she arrived on the block, somebody fired bullets into the air to scare her off. She refused to run. She rented a house nearby, and then, one day, she saw him, in the street, just as she had expected. She was perfectly still. She didn't want him dead. She wanted him brought to justice. Years after this, in a shack in Juarez, I asked her best friend, Berta Alicia Garcia, "Weren't you afraid?" "We were always afraid," she said, "but sometimes
the love of your children is stronger than fear itself.
Marisela called the police and told them everything. They sent three cops who arrived noisily at the front of the house, while Sergio escaped out the back.
They let him get away. Again.
Was this incompetence? Corruption? Fear? Marisela tried to follow his trail, asking questions in the surrounding small towns, but this area was totally controlled by the Zetas, and they don't like people asking questions. So Marisela decided to walk from Juarez to Mexico City, a journey of more than 1,000 miles, to beg the president himself to act. In terms of distance, this is like walking from Paris to Kosovo, or from Los Angeles to Denver. It was the last option she had left. So Marisela began her long march through the desert. In this heat, animals burrow into the ground and only come out at sunset. Marisela walked through it all, across sand dunes and mountains and dust storms. She had spent her life savings by now. Some days she and the other mothers marching with her went hungry. Some days they ate only bread smeared with mayonnaise. They slept where they could. Sometimes people let them into their homes or allowed them to lie down in their trucks. The heat on these roads is so intense that it looks as though the tarmac in front of you has melted into shimmering black pools. The dust and the glare were so bad that her son Juan's eyes became infected, and for 2 days he was blind. He walked, holding his mother's shoulder. It was as if she thought she could outpace her grief. Everybody in the country was watching and asking. If a nurse with no resources and no money can find a murderer, how come the police can't find him with everything they've got? What is happening to our country? When, after 3 months of walking, she made it to Mexico City, President Calderón refused to see her. In the video clips from this time, you can see her face becoming slowly misshapen by grief. That is when Marisela heard rumors that started to make it possible to make sense of this whole story. Sergio, she was told, is a Zeta. That is why the police would not touch him. That is why he kept escaping. When Marisela got her final lead on where Sergio was, the police were finally honest with her. If he's with the Zetas, we're not going to be able to do anything, because they run the state, they told her. If we do a bust, it's because they allow us to do it. We don't bust people just like that. They were apologetic, but they explained that the Zetas give them money if they serve them, and death if they don't. I found myself thinking back to the start of this war. Arnold Rothstein was allowed to shoot at cops and walk away a free man. The wealth that came from controlling the market in criminalized drugs bought more than fancy fur coats for Carolyn. It bought him a place above and beyond the law. At first he bought freedom from being prosecuted for the crimes involved in running his drug business, and then it spread from there, buying him immunity for the laws surrounding theft and extortion and murder, like an oil slick that slowly covers the whole society in its goop. This oil slick, I began to see, covers Mexico today. First, the drug dealers bought immunity from the drug laws. Then they bought the law itself. By joining the Zetas somewhere along the line, Sergio had placed himself above the law. This is what the desire to repress drugs has wrought. But Ruby always knew her mother wouldn't abandon her. Marisela believed she had one card left to play. Go public. Tell the world everything. She went to the state capital in Chihuahua City and announced to the world's press everything she had found, that the Zetas now ran the state and could do what they liked. The governor publicly dismissed her. She had arrived in early December, and she invited the governor to Christmas dinner on the doorstep of the state capitol building, because She wasn't leaving until Sergio was arrested.
What's the government waiting for? That he come and finish me? She said. Then let him kill me. But here, in front, to see if it makes them ashamed.
This was one of the most tightly policed places in Mexico, guarded by the federal police, not local police, and the military. But one night, at 8 o'clock, the gates to the capital started to close, and the area suddenly emptied of police and soldiers. A man approached her, now, right in front of the security cameras, in the shadow of the offices of the city police. He took out a gun. He put the gun to her head. He pulled the trigger. But the gun didn't go off. Something had jammed. Maricela's brother tried to throw a chair at the hitman. Maricela ran. The hitman ran after her. As they were both running, he pulled out another gun, and this time he shot her straight in the head. On the morning of her funeral, her business was burned down, and a man who resembled Maricela's boyfriend was kidnapped off the street nearby, suffocated to death, and dumped for everyone to see. Those searching for the disappeared disappear. Those seeking justice for the murdered are murdered, until the silence swallows everything. This is all happening in a city with a Walmart and a Pizza Hut and several KFCs. Maricela's eldest son, Juan, made it to the United States. I met him in a city there that he has asked me not to name for his own safety. I just want for you to understand, he said, who the real victims are in this war. It's not the cartels, it's not the police, but the people coming between them in this war. When you picture the 70,000 dead, don't picture a drug dealer or a drug user. Picture Maricela. She is more representative. And it is all, he says, for nothing. Since the war started, the cartels have got stronger. The drugs, they won't stop. If you walk the streets of Mexico and the United States, drugs are still selling on the streets. Drugs are still in the schools. They haven't stopped anything at all. Of course, the control of the drugs, the routes, is what gives them the money to pay off cops, military, federal police, everyone. Juan told me. If you legalize drugs, they are going to lose a lot of money. When they legalized alcohol in the United States, lots of gangsters were bankrupted. Would it be similar in Mexico, I ask him, if drugs were legalized? Of course. There's going to be less sources of money. But he feared that now the cartel's control is so deep they would simply transfer to other forms of crime. As he spoke, I found myself thinking back to the start of this war. Harry Anslinger himself wrote in the 1960s, "Prohibition, conceived as a moral attempt to improve the American way of life, would ultimately cast the nation into a turmoil. One cannot help but think in retrospect that prohibition, by depriving Americans of their vices, only created the avenues through which organized crime gained its firm foothold." Maricela's other son, Paul, is severely autistic, so he can't fully understand what happened. But when we met, he wanted to show me something. It is Google Maps on a laptop. He looks obsessively at the house where he lived with Maricela. He says, staring at the screen, "It's dangerous. I can't go back, but my house is fine. Nothing's going to happen. I hope they don't burn it. I hope they don't burn my house. Everything's going to be fine over there." And he smiles, awkwardly, looking away from me. Difficult questions continued to be asked about the case and what it revealed about the drug war and corruption in Mexico. In November 2012, the Mexican police surrounded a house in the state of Zacatecas. 4 men were shot dead. One of them was Sergio. It is not what the family wanted. Now there will be no trial. There will be no opportunity to ask any uncomfortable questions. Before all this happened, back when she was a nurse, Marisela had something she loved to do. She would take a break from looking after her kids and working hard for them, and she would climb onto a motorbike and ride far out into the desert with the sand and the breeze in her hair. As I traveled across Mexico, I kept asking myself, if it is condemning 60,000 of their countrymen to violent murder and has butchered the rule of law, why is this country fighting the drug war at all? The most articulate analyst of the drug war I could find is Sandra Rodriguez, a journalist in her early 40s. She has remained at her post as chief crime reporter for the Juarez newspaper El Diario, even as her colleagues are murdered all around her. Over a glass of wine in a friend's apartment in Juarez, I asked her why this was happening to her city, and she said straight off, "Mexico is not deciding this policy. This war, this criminalization strategy, is imposed by the U.S. government." I only really understood what she meant later, when I started researching the history of how this happened. In the 1930s, Mexico watched its neighbor to the north launch drug prohibition, and they saw that it wouldn't work, so they decided to choose a very different path. In Mexico City, the country's leading expert on drugs was a sober-minded doctor named Leopoldo Salazar Viñera, who ran a hospital treating drug addicts, so he was considered to be a good person to put in charge of the country's drug policy. The president appointed him chief of the Alcohol and Narcotic Service. This Mexican started to make the same discoveries as the silenced California doctor Henry Smith Williams at precisely the same time. He published a 14-year study demonstrating that cannabis does not cause psychosis and talking about the myth of marijuana. And when it came to other drugs, he explained, "It is impossible to break up the traffic in drugs because of the corruption of the police and also because of the wealth and political influence of some of the traffickers." Unless, that is, you resist the whole idea of the drug war. Keep drugs legal, he said. Have their sale controlled and supplied by the state so it can regulate their use, purity, and price. This would prevent criminals from controlling the trade, and so end drug trafficking and the violence and chaos it causes. Just as Henry Smith Williams had to be crushed by Anslinger for showing there was a better alternative to prohibition, so did Leopoldo Salazar. Harry started demanding that he be fired. He instructed Mexico's representative at the League of Nations that addicts were criminals first and addicts afterwards. And before long, on American orders, he was forced from office. But Mexico wouldn't surrender its convictions for long. A few years later, it resumed providing narcotics legally to addicts who needed them in order to smother the new rise of the cartels. Harry responded by immediately cutting off the entire country's supply of opiates for pain relief in its hospitals. Mexicans literally writhed in agony. Mexico now had no choice. Its government started to fight the drug war obediently, and the U.S. Treasury's officials declared, "This is a notable victory for Harry Anslinger." The first step of Marisela's long march was taken on that day. The U.S. government has approached Mexico with the same threat as the cartels, plato o plomo, silver or lead. We can give you economic aid to fight this war, or we can wreck your economy if you don't. Your choice. What is never an option is to pursue a rational drug policy. In 2012, not long after Marisela was killed, Michel Leonhardt, the head of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, said that the level of violence and death in Mexico is, in fact, a sign of success in the fight against drugs. On one of my final days in Juarez, I was driven out to the sand dunes that lie just beyond the city's sprawl and I looked back over the flat, semi-abandoned city where Ruby met Sergio, and Marisela found her in the pile of pig bones. I ran my fingers through the prickly hot white sand and tried to picture these three teenagers I've learned so much about sitting together at a party in a Mexico that had been allowed to choose drug peace instead of drug war. Lady Gaga is playing in the background. Ruby is texting her mother, laughing. Juan, stripped of his angel wings, is chatting with Rosalio about World of Warcraft. They might, I like to think, have been friends. Part 4. The Temple. Chapter 11. The Grieving Mongoose. Sometimes, after journeying to the front lines of the drug war in Brownsville or in Juarez or in Tent City, I would go back to an anonymous hotel room and ask myself one question. Why? Why are these people being shot or beheaded or cooked? What is the purpose of this war? I looked again at the official reasons. The United Nations says the war's rationale is to build a drug-free world. We can do it. U.S. government officials agree, stressing that there is no such thing as recreational drug use. So this isn't a war to stop addiction, like that in my family, or teenage drug use. It is a war to stop drug use among all humans everywhere. All these prohibited chemicals need to be rounded up and removed from the earth. That is what we are fighting for. I began to see this goal differently after I learned the story of the drunk elephants, the stoned water buffalo, and the grieving mongoose. They were all taught to me by a remarkable scientist in Los Angeles named Professor Ronald K. Siegel. The tropical storm in Hawaii had reduced the mongoose's home to a mess of mud, and lying there amid the dirt and the water was the mongoose's mate, dead. Professor Siegel, a silver-haired official advisor to two presidents and to the World Health Organization, was watching this scene. The mongoose found the corpse, and it made a decision. It wanted to get out of its mind. 2 months before, the professor had planted a powerful hallucinogen called Silver Morning Glory in the pen. The mongooses had all tried it, but they didn't seem to like it. They stumbled around, disoriented, for a few hours, and had stayed away from it ever since. But not now. Stricken with grief, the mongoose began to chew. Before long, it had tuned in and dropped out. It turns out this wasn't a freak occurrence in the animal kingdom. It's routine. As a young scientific researcher, Siegel had been confidently told by a supervisor that humans were the only species that seek out drugs to use for their own pleasure. But Siegel had seen cats lunging at catnip, which, he knew, contains chemicals that mimic the pheromones in a male tomcat's pee. So, he wondered, could a supervisor really be right? Given the number of species in the world, aren't there others who want to get high or stoned or drunk? This question set him on a path that would take 25 years of his life. Studying the drug-taking habits of animals from the mongooses of Hawaii to the elephants of South Africa to the grasshoppers of Soviet-occupied Czechoslovakia. It was such an implausible mission that in one marijuana field in Hawaii, he was taken hostage by the local drug dealers because when he told them he was there to see what happened when mongooses ate marijuana, they thought it was the worst police cover story they had ever heard. What Ronald K. Siegel discovered seems strange at first. He explains in his book, Intoxication. After sampling the numbing nectar of certain orchids, bees drop to the ground in a temporary stupor, then weave back for more. Birds gorge themselves on inebriating berries, then fly with reckless abandon. Cats eagerly sniff aromatic, pleasure plants, then play with imaginary objects. Cows that browse special range weeds will twitch, shake, and stumble back to the plants for more. Elephants purposely get drunk off fermented fruits. Snacks of magic mushrooms cause monkeys to sit with their heads in their hands, in a posture reminiscent of Rodin's Thinker. The pursuit of intoxication by animals seems as purposeless as it is passionate. Many animals engage these plants, or their manufactured allies, despite the danger of toxic or poisonous effects. Noah's Ark, he found, would have looked a lot like London on a Saturday night. In every country and almost every class of animal, Siegel explains, I found examples of not only the accidental but the intentional use of drugs. In West Bengal, a group of 150 elephants smashed their way into a warehouse and drank a massive amount of moonshine. They got so drunk they went on a rampage and killed 5 people, as well as demolishing 7 concrete buildings. If you give hash to male mice, they become horny and seek out females. But then they find they can barely crawl over the females, let alone mount them. So after a little while they yawn and start licking their own penises. In Vietnam, water buffalo have always shunned the local opium plants. They don't like them. But when the American bombs started to fall all around them during the war, the buffalo left their normal grazing grounds, broke into the opium fields, and began to chew. They would then look a little dizzy and dulled. When they were traumatized, it seems, they wanted, like the mongoose, like us, to escape from their thoughts. I kept returning to the UN pledge to build a drug-free world. There was one fact above all others that I kept placing next to it in my mind. It is a fact that seems, at first glance, both obvious and instinctively wrong. Only 10% of drug users have a problem with their substance. Some 90% of people who use a drug, the overwhelming majority, are not harmed by it. This figure comes not from a pro-legalization group, but from the United Nations Office on Drug Control, the global coordinator of the drug war. Even William Bennett, the most aggressive drug czar in U.S. history, admits, non-addicted users still comprise the vast bulk of our drug-involved population. This is hard to dispute, yet hard to absorb. If we think about people we know, it seems about right. Only a small minority of my friends who drink become alcoholics, and only a small minority of the people I know who use drugs on a night out have become addicts. But if you think about how we are trained to think about drugs, this seems instinctively wrong, even dangerous. All we see in the public sphere are the casualties. The unharmed 90% use in private, we rarely hear about it or see it. The damaged 10%, by contrast, are the only people we ever see using drugs out on the streets. The result is that the harmed 10% make up 100% of the official picture. It is as if our only picture of drinkers were a homeless person lying in a gutter necking neat gin. This impression is then reinforced with the full power of the state. For example, in 1995, the World Health Organization, or WHO, conducted a massive scientific study of cocaine and its effects. They discovered that experimental and occasional use are by far the most common types of use, and compulsive dysfunctional use is far less common. The US government threatened to cut off funding to the WHO unless they suppressed the report. It has never been published. We know what it says only because it was leaked. As I write this, I feel uncomfortable. The 10% who are harmed are most vivid to me. They are some of the people I love most. And there is another, more complex reason why I feel awkward writing about this. For anybody who suspects that we need to reform the drug laws, there is an easier argument to make, and a harder argument to make.
The easier argument is to say that we all agree drugs are bad. It's just that drug prohibition is even worse. I have made this argument in debates in the past. Prohibition, I said, doesn't stop the problem. It simply piles another series of disasters onto the already existing disaster of drug use. In this argument, we are all anti-drug. The only difference is between prohibitionists who believe the tragedy of drug use can be dealt with by more jail cells in California and more military jeeps on the streets of Juarez, and the reformers who believe the tragedy of drug use can be dealt by moving those funds to educate kids and treat addicts. There's a lot of truth in this argument. It is where my instincts lie. But as I try to think through this problem, I have to admit it's only a partial truth. Here, I think, is the harder, more honest argument. Some drug use causes horrible harm, as I know very well, but the overwhelming majority of people who use prohibited drugs do it because they get something good out of it. A fun night out dancing, the ability to meet a deadline, the chance of a good night's sleep, or insights into parts of their brain they couldn't get to on their own. For them, it's a positive experience, one that makes their lives better. That's why so many of them choose it. They're not suffering from false consciousness or hubris. They don't need to be stopped from harming themselves because they are not harming themselves. As the American writer Nick Gillespie puts it, far from our drugs controlling us, by and large we control our drugs. As with alcohol, the primary motivation is to enjoy ourselves, not to destroy ourselves. There is such a thing as responsible drug use. And it's the norm, not the exception. So, although it is against my instincts, I realized I couldn't give an honest account of drug use in this book if I talked only about the harm it causes. If I am serious about this subject, I also have to look at how drug use is deeply widespread and mostly positive. Professor Siegel's story of buzzing cows and tripping bees is, he believes, a story about us. We are an animal species. As soon as plants began to be eaten by animals for the first time, way back in prehistory, before the first human took his first steps, the plants evolved chemicals to protect themselves from being devoured and destroyed. But these chemicals could, it soon turned out, produce strange effects. In some cases, instead of poisoning the plant's predators, they, quite by accident, altered their consciousness. This is when the pleasure of getting wasted enters history. All human children experience the impulse early on. It's why, when you were little, you would spin around and around, or hold your breath to get a head rush. You knew it would make you sick, but your desire to change your consciousness a little, to experience a new and unfamiliar rush, outweighed your aversion to nausea. There has never been a society in which humans didn't serially seek out these sensations. High in the Andes, in 2000 BC, they were making pipes through which they smoked hallucinogenic herbs. Ovid said drug-induced ecstasy was a divine gift. The Chinese were cultivating opium by AD 700. Hallucinogens and chemicals caused by burning cannabis were found in clay pipe fragments from William Shakespeare's house. George Washington insisted that American soldiers be given whiskey every day as part of their rations. "The ubiquity of drug use is so striking," the physician Andrew Weil concludes, "that it must represent a basic human appetite." Professor Siegel claims the desire to alter our consciousness is the fourth drive in all human minds, alongside the desire to eat, drink, and have sex. And it is biologically inevitable. It provides us with moments of release and relief. Thousands of people were streaming into a 10-day festival in September, where they were planning, after a long burst of hard work, to find some chemical release,
relaxation, and revelry. They found drugs passed around the crowd freely, to anybody who wanted them. Everyone who took them soon felt an incredible surge of ecstasy. Then came the vivid, startling hallucinations. You suddenly felt, as one user put it, something that was new, astonishing. Irrational to rational cognition. Some people came back every year because they loved this experience so much. As the crowd thronged and yelled and sang, it became clear it was an extraordinary mix of human beings. There were farmers who had just finished their harvest, and some of the biggest celebrities around. Their names, over the years, included Sophocles, Aristotle, Plato, and Cicero. The annual ritual in the temple at Eleusis, 18 kilometers northwest of Athens, was a drug party on a vast scale. It happened every year for 2,000 years, and anybody who spoke the Greek language was free to come. Harry Anslinger said that drug use represents nothing less than an assault on the foundations of Western civilization. But here, at the actual foundations of Western civilization, drug use was ritualized and celebrated. I first discovered this fact by reading the work of the British critic Stuart Walton in a brilliant book called Out of It. And then I followed up with some of his sources, which included the work of Professor Orr Gordon Wasson, Professor Carl Ruck, and other writers. Everyone who attended the Eleusinian Mysteries was sworn to secrecy about what happened there, so our knowledge is based on scraps of information that were recorded in its final years, as it was being suppressed. We do know that a special cup containing a mysterious chemical brew of hallucinogens would be passed through the crowd, and a scientific study, years later, seemed to prove it contained a molecular relative of LSD taken from a fungus that infested cereal crops and caused hallucinations. The chemical contents of this cup were carefully guarded for the rest of the year. The drugs were legal. Indeed, this drug use was arranged by public officials and regulated. You could use them, but only in the designated temple, for those 10 days. One day, in 415 BC, a party-going general named Alcibiades smuggled some of the mystery drug out and took it home for his friends to use at their parties. Walton writes, "Caught in possession with intent to supply, he was the first drug criminal." But while it was a crime away from the temple and other confined spaces, it was a glory within it. According to these accounts, it was Studio 54, spliced with St. Peter's Basilica, revelry with religious reverence. They believed the drugs brought them closer to the gods, or even made it possible for them to become gods themselves. The classicist Dr. D.C.A. Hillman wrote that the founding fathers of the Western world were drug users, plain and simple. They grew the stuff, they sold the stuff, and more important, they used the stuff. The ancient world didn't have a Nancy Reagan. It didn't wage a billion-dollar drug war. It didn't imprison people who used drugs, and it didn't embrace sobriety as a virtue. It indulged. And from this world in which drugs were a universally accepted part of life sprang art, literature, science, and philosophy. The West would not have survived without these so-called junkies and drug dealers. There was some political grumbling for years that women were behaving too freely during their trances, but this annual festival ended only when the drug party crashed into Christianity. The early Christians wanted there to be one route to ecstasy, and one route only, through prayer to their God. You shouldn't feel anything that profound or pleasurable, except in our ceremonies at our churches. The first tugs towards prohibition were about power and purity of belief. If you're going to have one God and one church, you need to stop experiences that make people feel that they can approach God on their own. It's no coincidence that when new drugs come along, humans often use religious words to describe them, like ecstasy. They are often competing for the same brain space, our sense of awe and joy. So, when the Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity and brought the empire with him, the rituals at the temple at Eleusis were doomed. They were branded a cult and shut down by force. The new Christianity would promote wine only in tiny sips. Intoxication had to be sparing. This forcible repression by Christianity, Walton explains, represents the beginning of systematic repression of the intoxication impulse in the lives of Western citizens. Yet in every generation after, some humans would try to rebuild their own temple at Eleusis, in their own minds, and wherever they could clear a space free of local anslingers. Harry Anslinger, it turns out, represented a trend running right back to the ancient world. When Sigmund Freud first suggested that everybody has elaborate sexual fantasies, that it is as natural as breathing, he was dismissed as a pervert and lunatic. People wanted to believe that sexual fantasy was something that happened in other people, filthy people, dirty people. They took the parts of their subconscious that generated these wet dreams and daydreams and projected them onto somebody else, the depraved people over there who had to be stopped. Stuart Walton and the philosopher Terence McKenna both write that we are at this stage with our equally universal desire to seek out altered mental states. McKenna explains, "We are discovering that human beings are creatures of chemical habit, with the same horrified disbelief as when the Victorians discovered that humans are creatures of sexual fantasy and obsession. Just as we are rescuing the sex drive from our subconscious and from shame, so we need to take the intoxication drive out into the open where it can breathe." Stuart Walton calls for a whole new field of human knowledge called intoxicology. He writes, "Intoxication plays, or has played, a part in the lives of virtually everybody who has ever lived. To seek to deny it is not only futile, it is a dereliction of an entirely consecutive part of who we are." After 25 years of watching stoned mice, drunken elephants, and tripping mongooses, Ronald K. Siegel tells me he suspects he has learned something about this. "We're not so different from the other animal life forms on this planet," he says. When he sees people raging against all drug use, he is puzzled. "They're denying their own chemistry," he says. "The brain produces endorphins. When does it produce endorphins? In stress and in pain. What are endorphins? They are morphine-like compounds. It's a natural occurrence in the brain that makes them feel good. People feel euphoric sometimes. These are chemical changes. With the same molecular structures that these plants we use to make our drugs are producing. We're all producing the same stuff." "Indeed," he continues, "the experience you have in orgasm is partially chemical. It's a drug. So people deny they want this? Come on. It's fun. It's enjoyable. And it's chemical. That's intoxication." He seems for a moment to think back over all the animals guzzling drugs he has watched over all these years. "I don't see," he says, "any difference in where the chemical came from." "This is in us. It is in our brains. It is part of who we are." But this leaves us with another mystery. If the drive to get intoxicated is in all of us, and if 90% of people can use drugs without becoming addicted, what is happening with the 10% who can't? What is different about them? It's a question I had been circling all my life. As I looked for experts who might be able to answer this question, I discovered that a disproportionate number of them seemed to be clustered together in just a few blocks of the downtown east side of Vancouver, in Canada. Chapter 12. Terminal City. Ever since I was a child, I've been asking myself, what causes addiction? What is addiction? I'd heard many explanations over the years. It's a moral failing. It's a disease. It's carried in the genes. I believed this was, ultimately, a mystery. But when I arrived in Canada, I learned that a small band of dissident scientists has been uncovering the answers to my questions, almost unnoticed, for several decades now. Their findings were so radically different from anything I had been told before that it took some time to absorb what they were really saying. The story of how they came to their discoveries began in the last days of the Holocaust, when a Jewish mother smuggled her baby out of a ghetto. Judith Lovey awoke from a dream that her parents were being murdered, to find that her breast milk had dried up. Her four-month-old baby, Gabor, was crying. He cried all the time. She had grown up as a daughter of a wealthy doctor, but now she was alone, crammed into a building with over 1,000 people, all infested with lice, and there was shit smeared on the floor because the toilets were overflowing. She knew she was not allowed out onto the streets until the afternoon, because when you were a Jew in the Budapest ghetto in 1944, walking out your door any earlier could get you shot. By then, the only milk she could buy for her baby would be sour. She had married Andor just a few months ago, but now he was gone. He had been taken as a forced laborer. He might have been digging ditches for the Hungarian army, or he might have been dead. She had no way of knowing. The only reason she woke up in the morning, the only reason she went on, was to look after her son, in the hope she could somehow get him out. But she doubted it. She believed that, at the age of 24, she was going to be killed, along with her child. Judith was right about her parents. At just about that time, they were being murdered. The last time she had seen them was on a train platform in Budapest. She had wanted to go back to their town with them, but her father told her, by some instinct, not to leave the city. All around them, 80% of the country's Jews were being rounded up and exterminated with remarkable efficiency. Her parents and sister were seized after they got home, and sent to Auschwitz. As the Red Army troops began to besiege Budapest, the Nazis started taking Jews from the ghetto down to the river and shooting them outright. Judith called the doctor because she was afraid that Gabor's endless crying meant he was sick. "I'll come, of course," the doctor told her. "But I should tell you, all my Jewish babies are crying." Many years and many thousands of miles from there, the memory of these infant screams would help Gabor. Once he had become a doctor himself, to make a crucial discovery about the nature of addiction. He asked himself, how did the Jewish babies know they were in terrible danger? Why did they scream? One day, Judith noticed that another woman in the ghetto was being visited by a Christian friend. She thrust Gabor at him and begged, "Get him out of here!" She gave this anonymous Christian the address of a place outside the ghetto where her friend was hiding, and she begged him to take her child there. Without her baby, Judith was entirely alone, but she believed he, at least, would survive. 3 weeks later, the Russian army liberated Budapest from the Nazis, and she quickly reclaimed her child. A year after that, she found Andor, weighing just 90 pounds, and wearing a German army uniform because it was the only clothing he could find. But it turned out his experience, of profound danger, of separation from his mother at a crucial moment, shaped the brain of baby Gabor in ways that would affect him for the rest of his life. When Gabor was 15, his family finally made it out of Europe, to Vancouver, the farthest dot on the map